Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we'll play some excerpts from our 13th annual Martin Luther King's birthday event here at WNYC. It was yesterday at the Apollo Theater, hosted by our All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, and me. One of the major highlights was the talk by Bishop Michael Curry, presiding bishop and president and CEO, even, of the Episcopal Church, who many people around the world, maybe including you, saw for the first time last year when he presided and gave a memorable sermon at the royal wedding. Yeah, some of you are going, oh, that guy. Well, he was memorable yesterday at the Apollo too, though we won't call it a sermon since it was in a secular space. But his theme was certainly derived from Scripture, to love your neighbor and love yourself. We'll play an extended excerpt now, picking it up a few minutes in after he cites the Apostle Paul, who cited love as the greatest virtue.
Dr. King said it this way: we must discover the power of love, the redemptive power of love. And when we discover that, we will be able to make of this old world a new world, because love is the only way. The only way. And if you didn't believe the Apostle Paul, you still don't believe Dr. King, maybe you'll believe Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy said it this way: when the power of love overcomes the love of power, then the world will know peace. There's power in love. Power in love. It is the only way. It is the only motivation. It is the only capacity and power that can move our souls and transform our lives and change this society and global community. Love is the way. It is the only way. If you don't remember anything else I say tonight, just remember that love is the only way. When you get back to work and that person gets on your nerves, and you know they've been talking about you behind your back, just remember that love is the only way. When you get on that subway tomorrow and somebody jumps in front of you when you're trying to get on, just remember before you speak, love is the only way. If you're driving in your car and somebody cuts in front of you, and you roll down your, excuse me, press your button to roll down your window, and you reach out with your hand to expound in sign language, just remember, give them two fingers and just tell them love is the only way. I say that because at the core of the message of Dr. King, but more importantly, at the core of the message of the great religious traditions of the world, at the core of the message of Jesus of Nazareth, you'll find the same in Judaism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam. At deep in our religious traditions, you will find this bold and daring conviction that love is not just a way. Love is the way. Amen. It is the only way. Amen. Long ago, some slaves in America's antebellum South composed poetry and song that we now often refer to as Negro spirituals. You heard our sister singing some of them walking down Freedom's Highway. And one of their spirituals says this: It says, if you cannot preach like Peter, and you cannot pray like Paul, you just tell the love of Jesus how he died to save us all. Yes. And then the refrain goes on, there is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. Oh, there is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. What those old slaves in their field grasped was that there is a healing power in love, a healing capacity in love that can lift us up when the gravity of reality would pull us down. My grandma used to like to sing a song in church. She said, I was sinking deep in sin, far from a distant shore, very deeply stained within, sinking to rise no more. But the master of the sea heard my despairing cry, and from the waters lifted me. Now safe am I. And then they would sing, oh, love lifted me. Love lifted me. When nothing else would help, love lifted me. Love has the capacity to set us free when the powers of this world would bind us and put us down. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You want to know the power that can lift you up? It's called love. Love the Lord your God. Love your neighbor. And while you're at it, love yourself. You think God created you because you're cute? No, no, no. God loved you and called you into being. Love the Lord your God. Jesus also said, quoting the Hebrew scriptures, you shall love your neighbor. Love your neighbor. And he didn't put a qualification on neighbor.
It's true. It's true.
Now, he didn't say you got to like your neighbor. But you got to love your neighbor. Love your neighbor. Love whoever they happen to be. Love the neighbor that you like. And love the neighbor that you don't like. Tell me somebody. Love the neighbor who's a member of your family. And love the neighbor who's a member of your family that drives you up a wall. Love the folk that you got to work with. I didn't say like them, love them. Love them the way God loves them. Love them the way God loves you. And you might find you have a different kind of neighbor. Love your Democratic neighbor. Help me, somebody. And if you got one, love your Republican neighbor. Right? Love your independent neighbor. Love your Baptist neighbor. Love your Methodist neighbor. Love your Catholic neighbor. Love your Jewish neighbor. Love your Muslim neighbor. Love your Hindu neighbor. Love, 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 love your neighbor. Love your neighbor. Oh, you don't believe me? Just ask Jesus. I'm quoting Matthew 22. It's in the book. But he said, love the Lord your God and your neighbor as yourself. Now stay with me on that one. Because you see, love makes room and space for others. Love shows respect and honor for others. Love creates a social order.
Yes,
every child of God is loved and respected and honored, not only before the eyes of God, but in the eyes of men, in the laws of men. You got to love yourself. Oh, let me stay with it. I know my time is running out. I remember, let me just speak as an African-American. I've been black, well, let me say, I've been colored. I've been Negro, I've been Afro, I've been African. Oh, I've been so many things. And I remember that journey because a lot of that journey was our struggle to love ourselves as God loves us. Now, I don't want to be too specific, but I remember as a young child growing up, and I'm 65 years old, so I go back a few years. And I remember when I was a little boy and my sister used to, my mama used to comb my sister's hair on Saturday night. Well, she combed it every day, but she had a hot comb. Are y'all with me on Saturday night? And I remember on Saturday night, there was a show called Perry Mason. Somebody y'all remember Perry Mason? And the music would be playing in the background and went something, da-da-dum, da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-bum, ba-da-dum, ba-bum, ba-da-dum, ba-bum, ba-da-dum, ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-bum. Well, when that music was going on, my mama would have that hot comb and they put the grease on my sister Sherry's head, and the music would go, ba-da-dum, ba-ba, ba-da-dum, ba-ba. Now, you know, I believe you should style yourself however you want to style yourself, but don't style yourself not trying to be yourself. You with me? You see what I'm getting at? I remember there was a product that could straighten kinky hair. And there was I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and there used to be a jingle on WUFO, was the black radio station. Yeah, the product, I believe, was called Conkaline. Y'all remember Conkaline? They used to have a jingle that said, if your hair is good and nappy, Conkaline will make it happy. There's nothing wrong with styling, nothing wrong at all with styling, but don't style to not be who you are. Style to accentuate who you authentically are. You got to love yourself, love your neighbor, and love your God. I'm going to sit down. I know this isn't a church, because a church would never have a clock like this in front of a preacher. But I'm going to sit down in a minute. Some years ago, I was pastoring a church in Lincoln Heights, Ohio, on the outskirts of Cincinnati. Lovely congregation. And my wife and I were young in our, I guess I was late 20s by that time. And we moved into the parsonage, which was attached to the church. And everything was fine until the winter came. And when the winter came, there's a large field behind our house and the church complex. When the winter came, all the field mice who were out in the field in the summer, everybody got holy and sanctified. And they all came into the church. I mean, the church complex, the church, the parish hall, and the parsonage itself. I mean, we were like overrun with mice, and we were doing everything we could. And part of the problem was we had our oldest daughter now, then was like 2 or 3. So we had a toddler running around the house, and the pest control people, you know, had to use. One man said we specialize in nonviolent means of extermination. I didn't know what that meant when the mice didn't know what that meant, and I still don't know what that means. All I know is it didn't work. So finally, one day, a friend of ours said, I think I got the solution for your problem. I said, well, what's that? He said, well, I got a cat. Actually, I have 2 cats and a dog. And one of the cats and the dog are beating up on this other cat. And so you can have the cat who's getting beaten up on. I said, wait a minute, I don't need a cat who's already losing a fight. But nothing was working, the exterminators weren't working. And so I said, well, what's the cat's name? And she said, well, cat's name is Muffin. I said, at least the cat could have named Killer or something like that. But anyway, I was waiting on Muffin. So I went over to Liz's house and I bought, you know, one of those cases. And my time's almost out, but I bought one of those cases and met Muffin. And when she came out, I got to tell you, she was about the ugliest cat. She was one of those tortoiseshell colored cats. And I mean, she really was. And like had patches of hair missing from different spots. I guess she had really been beaten up pretty bad. But anyway, I got her and put her in the cage. I've never seen somebody so happy to get incarcerated in all my life. That cat. Anyway, so I put her in the cage and I took her on back to the house and just kind of, we let her out and kind of tried to coax her out and in her environment. In her new environment, we had a German Shepherd dog. We had nicknamed his name was actually Bishop. I thought that was cute then. Anyway, Muffin and Bishop became fast friends, and that was really lovely. It was beautiful, and that was all fine. And our daughter, you know, she was two or three, and so she loved the new cat. And everything was fine, and Muffin seemed to be happy, and everything was going along well. And days went by, and Muffin wasn't catching any mice. She was eating well. A friend of mine said, don't feed her so much. She needs to keep that lean, mean, hungry look to her. So anyway, after a little while, I got up in the middle of the night and was going into the kitchen to get something. And I walked in the kitchen, had to go around and go through the living room to get there. And I looked, and I saw Muffin in that crouching tiger position. And I said, I think she's hunting. And so I looked at her and watched. I said, I'm going to watch this. And I watched. And I saw Muffin take a step. And then she took another step. And see, usually she'd be dribbling by now. I mean, this cat was really, I mean, this was a dysfunctional cat who had some real issues. And she wasn't dribbling or anything. And she just took another step. And then, you know how they go down real low? Like she get down in the grass. And then she pounced up. And I saw it. Mickey Mouse bit the dust. I saw it. And that from that night on, Muffin was hunting every night. I mean, every night. And one time I got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and I put my foot in my slippers. I said, oh Lord, and I took it out and I said, oh, look at this. And my wife says, see, she gives you more than folk give you in church. See, they just give you a little dollar or two. She gave you half of what the Lord gave her. Anyway, from that night forward, Muffin was hunting every night. You'd get up in the morning, walk through the living room, it was like going through a cemetery. I mean, there were carcasses everywhere. And eventually she wiped out the mice, and the next winter, we did not have mice in our house. And I realized something. I said, you know something? As long as Muffin was being mistreated and not allowed to be who and what the Lord put her on this earth to be, she was dribbling and dysfunctional. But when that cat was allowed to be what the Lord put her on this earth to be, she wasn't just an ordinary cat. She was Super Cat. And I'm here to tell you, the old song says it is no secret what God can do. What he did for St. Paul, he'll do for you. Well, I'm here to tell you, it is no secret what God can do. What he did for Muffin, he'll do for you. Love the Lord, love your neighbor, and love yourself. God bless you.
All right. How good was that? One of the major highlights of yesterday's Martin Luther King birthday event at the Apollo Theater, hosted by our All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, and me. That was Michael Curry, Bishop Michael Curry, presiding bishop and president and CEO of the Episcopal Church, who many of you probably saw for the first time last year when he presided and gave a memorable sermon at the royal wedding. Such a treat to have him with us at the Apollo yesterday for Martin Luther King weekend. More excerpts right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we are airing excerpts this hour from our 13th annual Martin Luther King's birthday event. It was yesterday at the Apollo Theater, hosted by our All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, and me. Up next, an excerpt from a conversation between Jamie, me, and WNYC's Kai Wright. Many of you who listen to our podcasts know Kai from his podcast series Caught, his podcast series There Goes the Neighborhood, his podcast series The United States of Anxiety. These are names that many of you know and programming that many of you know. He was one of our hosts for the series Indivisible during the first 100 days of the Trump administration. And so Kai Wright joined Jamie and me on the stage yesterday, and we'll enter this one as I was letting people know about a well-deserved honor that was bestowed on Kai just a few weeks ago. I want to say also on youth, but from a very different vantage point, I want you all to know that this year Kai and his team won broadcast journalism's highest honor, a Columbia University DuPont Award. And And the thing about the DuPont is that it's not as well known as an Oscar or an Emmy or a Peabody to the general public, but in radio and television journalism, the DuPont is the greatest recognition, partly because it's for work that digs deep and makes a difference in society. Now, Kai won it for his podcast series called Caught, about kids in the juvenile justice system. So, audience, please recognize Kai Wright for winning the DuPont.
And you can still hear Caught.
Yes,
you can
absolutely
listen to Caught at WNYC.
So what were you trying to document with Caught, Kai, that hadn't been documented before?
Well, I was going to say very quickly, I mean, you know, our team won the award, but it was not about our team. It was about the young people that we profiled and what we were doing. I mean, so not to put anyone on the spot, you can decide for yourself, but how many of you, if you want to raise your hand, have yourself or someone in your life, a loved one, a family member, who has been incarcerated? I bet a whole lot. I certainly have, right? And we've arrived at this place as a society over the last few years where we're prepared to talk about prison reform and how, you know, for a variety of reasons, because it costs too much or because of the healthcare knock-ons or for a whole, are because of the violence that we've seen from the state against black bodies. But what has been striking to me is in that conversation, the people who we almost never hear from are people who are incarcerated themselves. Everybody other than the people who are in the maw of this thing get a place at the table. And so what we were trying to do with Caught is talk to young people who were stuck in this criminal justice system about that experience and let them speak for themselves and sort of shoot it from their lens. We just don't have that enough. And importantly, there was not a single, we profiled several young people, not one of them is innocent. No one claimed that they did not commit a crime. That is not the point. The point is, what do we do with people who need help? Do we lock them up and abuse them, or do we help them?
You want to tell us a short version of one of the stories, since the point is to humanize individuals, maybe the kid known as Z, or pick your one?
Yeah, I mean, Z is a great example. I mean, Z is somebody who is currently lost, literally lost in New York State prison system. I have no idea where he is. His mother doesn't know where he is. He's in the system somewhere. He was first arrested in sixth grade for a literal schoolyard fight out in Rockaway, and continued to hit the system again and again after that. And he, you know, he would make mistakes. He was a teenager, he was a kid, you know, and he kept making mistakes and the stakes kept getting higher. He was in Rikers when he turned 18 because of a stupid attempt to bully a cab driver because he couldn't pay for his girlfriend's ride. Was transferred on his 18th birthday to adult prison, where he remains. And the thing about Z was, you know, we went and we met his elementary school teachers. We went out to Rockaway and we sat down with these three women who had been teaching him since he was in kindergarten. We described to them what happened to him once he got to sixth grade, and they were shocked. They were like, "Who are you describing? That's not the kid I know." Mm-hmm. He did have mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. He was somebody who needed more attention than the other students, and they were giving it to him, and he was doing great. And then he moved to another school, and he didn't get that attention, right. And instead he got met by NYPD. And that's a lot of people who are in the system right now. That's a lot of the young people. So, you know, there are positive stories too. There's also folks who have made it through, but they are in spite of what we are doing to them as a society, not because of.
What makes, I really do urge you to listen to Caught. And the DuPont is wonderful, but what makes it such a meaningful series is that we, as a society, watch all of these fictionalized accounts of people, young people and others in the system. This is real. These are the voices of young people in the system telling their own stories. And we love this expression, slipped through the cracks. We are responsible for these young people. We as a society.
They're our children.
They're our children. And you can hear their voices on Caught and at WNYC. And as Kai says, judge for yourself.
And just one more thing, Jamie, and I'm sorry to have interrupted you there, but
no, please.
One of the things that I'm really passionate about with this series is that it's wonderful that we say folks' name when the state kills them. We say their name. Mm. We have to say their name before the state kills them. We have to say their name in sixth grade when NYPD is harassing them on the schoolyard. Mm-hmm. That is the place to start talking about this, not once there's a dead body in the streets.
There's another name that I'd like you to say, and you said it briefly a minute ago, but one of the episodes of one of your podcast series was about Ida B. Wells in particular. And as we do Unsung Heroes today at this event, I wonder if you'd like to tell everybody why you decided to single her out for a separate.
I hope I'm going to get to hear your Unsung Heroes as well. The thing about Ida is she's one of these folks that we are now saying her name. She comes up a lot. But I wonder how many people genuinely know Ida's story. I wish I could make required reading for all black people in America, but I think everybody, but at least all black people in America ought to read Paula Giddings' biography of Ida. It's called Ida, A Sword Among Lions. Paula is one of the most brilliant academics in America, and we should all read it. But the thing about it is, all of 20th century black politics was thought up by Ida Wells. Before we did it, she was making these arguments in the 1890s and the early 20th century. She was the first person to say that we cannot negotiate our way out of this, that we will have to disrupt and disobey is the only way that we will find freedom. She's first to say that. She was the first to articulate a black nationalist idea about self-reliance and economic self-reliance. She was the first to say that we should have a professionalized civil rights world, that the NAACP was her idea initially. And much of that we don't know because she was a difficult black woman who refused to take it, who refused to say no to things, and that made black men very uncomfortable, and it very much made white feminists very uncomfortable, because a lot of what she had to say about the white feminist movement was about the way in which they were prepared to throw black people under the bus in order to get their freedom. And so she was actively written out of history for a long time because she alienated those two constituencies with her truth-telling. And so I just think, you know, there are so many black women who have lived that since.
Great job, brother.
I wish we all would read that biography and live and know what she brought us.
How about you, Jamie? Did you bring an unsung hero today?
I carry an unsung hero with me every day, and her name is... I mean, there are so many, but I'm going to name Constance Baker Motley, who is not entirely unsung because she is Judge Constance Baker Motley. But before she was Judge Motley, she was at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And many people don't know, although I think most people in this room know, that she was the first woman at the Legal Defense Fund, that she was the first female attorney at the Legal Defense Fund, that she was a field officer at the Legal Defense Fund at a time when women were not in the field on these kinds of cases. In fact, there weren't very many women attorneys working in the field in the 1950s, that she argued Brown versus Board of Education with Thurgood Marshall in the Supreme Court at the podium, people don't know that she interviewed James Meredith, that she visited Dr. King in the Birmingham jail. These are the things that Constance Baker Motley did while her husband raised her son, Joel, and made them dinner so that she could do the fine work that
yes.
she did. That's what I'm talking about. And I will commend to all of you, there is a documentary out now about her life that her son has made in her honor, and he's shopping it around to schools so that young women and girls, but also boys and men, can learn more about this formidable, brilliant, fierce black woman, a name we should all know, Constance Baker Motley. That's my unsung hero. Oh, I'm getting to you, Brian. I'm getting to you. Because I know you have a wonderful, I think, sort of group of champions, we're calling them, right? Champions.
Right. We were talking about this backstage. And, you know, these days you can plug you can pluck an unsung hero from the news almost every day. And so this is an Associated Press story from this weekend, Dateline Saturday night, or time, Saturday 19th of January 2019, 29 minutes after midnight. And the story is, a federal judge has found four women guilty, this happened Friday, of entering a national wildlife refuge without a permit as they sought to place food and water in the Arizona desert for migrants. The four found guilty of misdemeanors in the case were volunteers for No More Deaths, which said in a statement, and that's because people actually die sometimes as they try to get through that desert. And they said in a statement the group had been providing life-saving aid to migrants. So let me say their names out loud. Yes. These volunteers were Natalie Hoffman, Una Holcomb, Madeline Hughes, and Zachilla Orozco McCormick. And Hoffman, in particular, according to the Associated Press, was found guilty of operating a vehicle inside Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, entering the federally protected area without a permit, and leaving water jugs and cans of beans there in August 2017. Apparently, leaving water for thirsty human beings can be a crime. So they are my newest unsung heroes.
Now, Brian, speaking of social justice work, this is my segue. you have a new social justice project.
I get to plug it,
yes. You're working on, right? Tell us about that.
This spring, we're going to launch a new show. It's a show about change and how we make change in America, both for the better and for the worse, and that we have nothing about our society is just the way it is. It is a crime to leave food and water in the desert, not just because of natural order, because somebody made the choice to make it a crime, and so everything about the way we live is by design. And that means everything about the way we live can be designed differently. And so we're going to launch a show that's about that, and that is going to try to reveal some of the social history that got us here and think big about the ways we might get someplace else.
WNYC's Kai Wright with Jamie Floyd and me from our MLK event yesterday. More excerpts in 1 minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we play excerpts from our Martin Luther King event yesterday at the Apollo Theater. And up next, an extended excerpt from my interview with Northwestern University historian Alden Morris, author of books including The Origins of the Civil Rights Movement, and Dr. Hazel Dukes, president of the New York State NAACP Conference. We enter this with Dr. Morris as we discuss the theme of the event, which was unsung heroes of the civil rights and pre-civil rights era.
The civil rights movement arose on the foundation of prior movements. These movements enabled the civil rights movement to become a great mass movement. So prior movements making the civil rights movement possible included the 1905 Niagara movement, the NAACP protest movement born in 1910, the 1920s Garvey movement of the 1920s, the 1941 Nonviolent March on Washington movement. Yes, there was a March on Washington movement before the famous 1963 March on Washington. And then also what was important to the Civil Rights Movement was the 1940s Nonviolent Sit-In and Freedom Rides movements that was organized by the Congress of Racial Equality. These unsung heroes and forgotten movements, they set the stage for the emergence of the great charismatic leader, Martin Luther King Jr.
But we cannot forget the women.
Of course.
Who was the backbone. There were Daisy Bates, the Little Rock Nine. She and her husband was put out of business. They owned a newspaper at that time, she gathered the parents for their children to receive quality education. Fannie Lou Hamer. These are the women that put their life on the line. They're the one, they didn't only prepare the food for the men, but they gave them directions. Because they took it from our sister who led the real fight to bring us to freedom. And so these women, it's born, it's in our DNA to be brave, to protect the families, our children, and indeed our communities. And so when you look at the history of NAACP, while there have only been three women that held the title of president before Kwaisi Mfume became the president and CEO, I'm the only living one of the four women.
And
our home in Baltimore, we would not have a home in Baltimore if it wasn't for a woman whose names will never be in the history book, Noelia McMillan. And so there is Mrs. Juanita Mitchell, who engraved her husband's name is known because he was known as the U.S. Senator, because he walked the halls on behalf of the NAACP. But it was his wife who integrated the law school in Baltimore, Maryland.
And Dr. Dukes, when we go all the way back to the founding of the NAACP in 1909, exactly 20 years before...
It was at the woman's home.
Go ahead.
It was the woman.
You knew where I was going with that.
It was Mary Overton who was listening to the radio of the lynching, and she called the men together. And she said, "What are we going to do about this? It's outrageous that I'm hearing on the radio night and day men being lynched, African-American men of color, men of Negro being lynched." So it was the woman who called the men together, and they got all of the highlights. But as you know your history, and women especially, and the young women in here, when you feel that you don't have any place to go, you do the calling and invite them in.
And Dr. Morris, that 1940s March on Washington that you mentioned, 20 years before the Dr. King one, was that not organized by Ella Baker?
No, that was organized by A. Philip Randolph. Once again, I want to echo what was just said. Women, black women, were central in all phases of the civil rights movement. We have to mention, when we talk about Mary White Overton and NAACP, we have to mention Ida B. Wells.
Yes.
Also, what we are learning now is that Coretta Scott King was far more in the early stages militant than her husband Martin Luther King. She helped educate
Absolutely.
Martin Luther King and to radicalize him. And so
it's
incorrect to see Coretta Scott King simply as some sort of chandelier hanging on the arms of Dr. King. One of the things that was great about the March on Washington movement in 1941, organized by A. Philip Randolph and Byard Rustin, but once again, many others, I'm sure that there were very serious numbers of women who helped spearhead.
Dr. Dorothy Heights.
Dorothy Heights and others. What is so crucial about that March on Washington movement is that it was a mass movement, and that it called for nonviolence, and mass nonviolence by black people. And once again, that laid the foundation for the coming of the modern civil rights movement. I want to also talk about a minute to ask the question, why and how could a nonviolent civil rights movement develop in the United States? Now, you do know that black people are not nonviolent naturally. No, I remember when I interviewed Reverend Hosea Williams, and we were talking about nonviolence, and this is what he had to say. Nonviolence as a way of life was just as foreign to blacks as flying a space capsule would be to a roach. So then, nonviolence had to be taught to Martin Luther King. It had to be taught to the black masses. And people like Bayard Rustin and Glenn Smiley went south during the Montgomery bus boycott. They met with King and they literally pumped nonviolence into his heart and in his mind and into his soul. And then the black masses had to become familiar with how to carry out nonviolent direct action. And so you had all of these nonviolent workshops held in churches and in parks and everywhere throughout the South. And that's how we got a nonviolent direct action movement, not because black people are naturally meek and just like to sing.
But you're absolutely right, Doc, that it was a thing that was taught to us. But even so, the nonviolent, sometimes we get confused with nonviolent. Nonviolent mean that we didn't pick up guns and knives to shoot. But we had our way of being violent in our own way, in our own right. Mm-hmm. The songs that we sung was saying to people, I'm not going to let anybody turn me around. That was a song saying that, you know, you might get those hoes. You might have the dogs on us, but we're not going to turn around. So that was, in a sense, a violent movement, but it was nonviolent in that. So we have to teach our young, especially now with the bullying that we have, we have to teach again that you can be nonviolent but violent. In a two-part way of how we do that. And so it's important that you brought that up, Dr. Morris, that we are nonviolent people. We were taught that. My mom was a very meek and humble woman, but there was a point that she had that you couldn't cross. And I have that same DNA.
There's
a point that you don't cross with me.
And Dr. Dukes, I've seen you on television with the late, great Dr. Roscoe Brown talk about Martin Luther King coming to your hometown of Montgomery as a young man to be minister of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church there, and finding the older generation of religious leaders, you said, were not ready to confront the white power structure and lead a movement. Can you tell our audience some of that history and the politics of Montgomery in that context?
Yes. It is the same today, as I said earlier. Older people think they know all of the, have all the knowledge and all the wisdom and all the power. Yes, because we've lived longer. I'm in that age. I'm a seasoned citizen. I'm not a senior citizen. And of course, I have lived longer than some of you in this audience. And yes, I do have wisdom to impart. But I am saying to the young people, come, learn, and be a part of the movement. It is good to know all of the rap songs. I love them. But you ought to know some hymns. And you ought to know some meaning of the hymns. You ought to know what Amazing Grace taught you. And what it means by many dangerous toils and snares you've already come. And so that means we don't want you falling into that. And so the older power structure in Alabama, I had some relatives at Dexter. Dexter was a sophisticated church, where most of our teachers and professors was at Dexter. They played a great part in the civil rights movement. But some of the older churches had what we would say unlearned. But they had book sense. They had wisdom. They might not have had the pronounced words correctly, but what they said and did got the attention of that. But King was eloquent, and so the white power structure could believe that here was this young man who could speak English, their English, their language, better than they could. At that time, I'm an Alabamian, and I can tell you about some of them. Don't have the time. Once Roy Wilkins was riding, going to Mississippi in a car, and Mr. White, who was our executive director, was light-skinned like you. They thought he was white, but he wasn't. And so they stopped them in the car, And this sheriff got out and he said, boy, where you all are going? And they said, we are going to a meeting. Why are you going to the meeting at? They told him where. He said, let me see your driver's license. So they reached in, Mr. Wilkins, Roy Wilkins, at that time who was our executive director, pulled out the NAACP card. The sheriff said, boy, you better have had that driver's license. It was an NAACP card, not a driver's license.
You know, I really want to again echo an important point. If we don't understand the black institutions like HBCUs, that is historically black colleges and universities, if we don't understand the bedrock institution, the black church, we will never understand the civil rights movement. And another unsung hero is Dr. Benjamin Mays.
Yes.
Benjamin Mays was the president of Morehouse College. If Benjamin Mays had not been at Morehouse College, the world would not have known Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Benjamin Mays mentored him, but because he was a preacher and a scholar, he was eloquent. And he gave Dr. King the appreciation and the beauty for words and oratory. And so then Dr. King decided that I will not try to be a doctor, because he was not doing very well in biology, by the way. And so, but with the example of somebody like Dr. Benjamin Mays, he decided to go into the ministry and to work for social change. But I would also add, it wasn't just Martin Luther King that Benjamin Mays mentored,
right,
but Floyd McKissick, yeah, Lerone Bennett, and many, many others. And so we have to understand the genius that was nestled within the black church and within the historically black colleges throughout the South and the nation.
The only reason I can sit here today is because of the black church. The teachers that I had at Sunday schools, my teachers in my school that learned me how to pronounce my words, how to stand up. I didn't read my recitation on Easter and Christmas. I recited them because I had learned them.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Dr. Alden Morris and Dr. Hazel Dukes. And Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we're listening to excerpts from our 13th annual Martin Luther King's birthday celebration yesterday at the Apollo Theater. And we'll close with some music from the event from Rutha Harris, one of the original Freedom Singers from Albany, Georgia, who also helped form the SNCC Freedom Singers, SNCC, acronym for the Students Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the Civil Rights Era, so the SNCC Freedom Singers, and she was a member of the group Sweet Honey and the Rock. And as an extra treat, Rutha Harris was introduced by our own WQXR classical music host, Terrence McKnight.
Now these, as I just said, these freedom songs are so important, the 50s and 60s, so important to the movement. Tell us just how important was this singing, how important what you all did to the action of the movement?
Personally, I feel that the songs of the civil rights movement were very vital, played a very vital role during the civil rights movement. And without the songs of the civil rights movement, I don't think there would have been a movement.
I won't argue with that. Now you're going to bring us some music.
Yes, I am.
And we all know this one. Woke up this morning. Ladies and gentlemen, Ms. Rutha Harris.
I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind walking and talking with my mind stay on freedom. I'm walking and talking with my mind stay on freedom. I'm walking and talking with my mind.
keep your mind. Stay on freedom. Hallelujah. 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 Thank you, Apollo.
And so thanks to Ruthie Harris, and thanks to everyone who came to or presented at or produced our Martin Luther King celebration at the Apollo yesterday. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and thanks to all of you for listening today.